the rain last night, we all did, of course, and I'm always taken to what it says in the book of Acts, as Luke has recorded, in Acts 14:17 in particular. I just love this verse. It says in Acts 14:17, "Yet he did not leave himself without witness, for he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness." Wow, what a verse. I just love that verse so much. And so every time it rains, I think of that. He sent us rains from heaven, you know, filling our heart with food and gladness. Isn't that great? It's enough to make a Baptist shout. But, you know, there was a lot of rain there. And as we say in Texas, it was raining cats and dogs. And I know because I stepped in a poodle. Thank you. Yes. But when I was in Colorado, going to college in the winter, we would go ice fishing, and some of the guys and I would go ice fishing just off the interstate there in Gunnison. And I remember one afternoon in particular, we were wildly successful. We caught, I think, 4 blocks and 3 bags of cubes. Thank you. Yes. And one spring, I didn't change my snow tires in time, and they melted. Well, nothing like a few jokes to get things going in the morning, and that was nothing like a few jokes. But we'll just go ahead and look at scientific evidence for creation. When I do a lot of traveling, I try and witness as the Lord leads, and you know, instead of saying, "Have you heard the Word of God?" You know, kind of take the back of the head and push it towards the Bible as you're talking. You kind of start in a disarming way and just ask them. I like to ask, "Are you on any kind of spiritual journey?" And you know, if they're Christians, they'll say, "Bless God, yeah, I'm going through the Psalms," or something like that. And if they're not, then they might have some questions. Well, what do you mean by a spiritual journey? But it's very disarming. It's very kind of a nice way to introduce somebody to the gospel without being overbearing. And that always leads me to share with them creation. Did you know that you've been created in God's image? Or something, just how the Spirit leads. And then, you know, sometimes they say something like, "Well, I don't believe there's any evidence for creation." And of course, a lot of Americans today have been taught nothing but what? Evolution, right. And when I was a non-believer, that's all I was taught was evolution. I didn't know there was a case for creation. I didn't know there was any problems with evolutionary theory. So my eyes were really opened about my second year in the Navy over in Vietnam off the coast. And so I began to do a study using literature and material from a little known organization that was just getting started called the Institute for Creation Research. Little did I know as I read through that material that someday I'd be writing some of that material. So it's really kind of neat how God has blessed and led. Well, this kind of starting off, you know, maybe in a little bit of a negative note, I'm sorry to do that, but why American nuns have left religion behind. That's an article that came out just a couple of years ago. And this includes many respondents who mentioned science as the reason that they don't believe in religious teachings. And that was 2 years ago. And then they were asked specifically, "Well, why is it that you don't believe in the Bible anymore? Why is it that you're embracing evolution?" And they gave two answers. The two most popular answers of these young people when they were interviewed was learning about evolution when they went away to college. So many Christians get their faith devastated in the introductory course in philosophy or biology or anything. And that should not be that way, but that's really tragic that happens. And then the second one is lack of any sort of scientific or specific evidence for a creator. Well, that really kind of caught me, and I thought, you know, we should be able to share with people that there is, you know, lots of evidence for creation out there. I mean, the case for creation is solid as we look at God's wonderful and magnificent creation, even though it's been corrupted by sin, right? We're living in a fallen world, are we not? And so even then, Paul tells us that there is a case for creation. This is one of my favorite verses, and this is something I taught Roy and our three daughters as they were growing up. "But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you, or the reason, the hopes that is in you, with meekness and with fear. With, you know, be gentle. You want to be very diplomatic as you share about creation. It's, you've heard the phrase, it's easier to win people with honey than vinegar. And so when you talk to somebody about maybe their spiritual journey or something, do it in a way that is edifying and not confrontational. And so what the Apostle Peter is saying here is have an apologia. That word means an apologetic. In other words, as you study God's Word, maybe as you study the creation account, know why you believe what you believe. Do you believe in creation? Hey, that's great. Now, why do you believe in creation as opposed to evolution? And so that's where I think this verse comes in, to have this apologetic, knowing why we believe what we believe. And that starts with the definition of science. Too often we don't really address what science is. And science is, there are multiple definitions, but we can say science is a systematic study of phenomena based on experimental investigation. And that experimental investigation includes observation, testing, repeating, and you would also add falsifiability as well. Now, I don't want to get too deep into this morning, except to say that as creation scientists, we certainly agree with this. We embrace what we call empirical science. Have you heard that phrase before when somebody says to you, well, that's not empirical? Do you know what that means? It means, well, you can't observe it, test it, or repeat it. And so, for example, yesterday when I was sharing about dinosaurs and the sightings of dinosaurs in medieval times, for example, that's not empirical, is it? Yeah, because we can't go back in time and redo the observations and all. And so we, for that reason, I make sure that the audience understands that the sightings of dinosaurs and the rundels that you saw in, you know, of the dinosaur in some of these Far Eastern countries, well, that's not empirical science. Empirical science is when you go into the laboratory, well, you put on a white lab coat, and then you go into a laboratory and you do the research there. And are we against that at ICR? No, we're not against that at all. We embrace that. We love science at ICR. And so sometimes the accusation, sadly, is made that the creationists are anti-science. And that's not the case. You know, we have our degrees in science from secular accredited institutions, and we've learned to separate the wheat from the chaff. And we, you know, I jumped through the hoops there and through the classes and so forth. And so we really do enjoy science in, for example, ICR. Science and the Bible go together like what? Butter and bread. They just go together beautifully. Because who is the originator, the creator of science, but the Lord Jesus himself? And so I like to say that science and the Bible are inextricably linked. I mean, they just dovetail together, just like politics and corruption. They go together. Okay, so you get the idea. So what's a take-home point? Creationists love science. As a matter of fact, who are some of the most brightest, brilliant scientists of the past? Well, they were scientists who loved the Lord and believed his word, like Newton, Kepler, Boyle, Maxwell, Faraday, George Washington Carver, Louis Pasteur. All these individuals did incredible scientific discoveries, and guess what? They loved the Lord. And so science and the Bible go together beautifully. So Christianity needs to identify where science leaves off and philosophy begins. And so that is some of the things that we teach all the time. What's the difference between empirical science, that which you can observe, test, and repeat, and when you step off from that and enter into the realm of philosophy, a philosophical interpretation? Let me give you some examples of what I mean. Psalm 14:1 is something we all understand, what the psalmist said, that the fool has said in his heart that there is no God. Now, atheists believe in something. An atheist is someone who believes in the scientifically strange, okay? I'm not condemning them, but they do believe something kind of strange, and that is that nothing created everything. You heard me say yesterday that there's two worldviews. One worldview says, in the beginning, nothing, okay? They're certainly open to that interpretation. And the other is, in the beginning, God. One who has always been there. And so we put our faith and trust in one who has always existed. We don't have to explain where God came from. And versus nothing. And I would say that really ours is a more reasonable faith. It's more reasonable belief that there is a creator who created everything. So here's a quiz this morning. Sorry, it's 9 o'clock and we're kind of prying open our eyes, but we got to have a quiz. At 13.8 billion years ago, our entire observable universe was the size of a peach and had a temperature of over a trillion degrees, okay? Well, a peach and a temperature over a trillion degrees, and remember, how long ago was this supposedly? 13.8 billion years ago, and so it wasn't the size of a grape or a watermelon, it was a peach, okay? And a trillion degrees, and so is this empirical?
No,
it's not empirical. We can't go back in time and make that observation and make those measurements and all that. And so this is, we have left the realm of empirical science and entered into kind of a philosophy, right? This is a philosophical interpretation. In other words, folks, what I'm saying is there any difference in saying this or saying in the beginning God? Right? So this was a one-time event that occurred in the unobserved past, right? God creating out of nothing was a one-time event that occurred in the unobserved past. Both maintain, you know, both require faith, don't they? But again, our faith is more reasonable. We put our faith in someone who is there. How did you have everything in the size of a peach 13 billion years ago? Now, how do they know that? And so those are questions to ask, not confrontationally, but just asking the questions. And you know what? That's what science is all about. Asking questions and making deductions based on the scientific evidence. And so nothing wrong with being diplomatic and simply asking the question. So how does he know that? Well, they really don't know that. That's based on the philosophy of evolution. Well, how about this? Let's try another one. Our bones and brains are composed of ancient atoms constructed by stellar fusion long before the solar system existed. Well, how about it? Is that observable, testable, repeatable science? Well, no, it's not. So we would say, again, this is not empirical, is it? That our bones and brains are composed of ancient atoms. We can say that our bones and brains are composed of atoms, right? Yeah, we can do that, and obviously they are. But to then take a giant step and enter into a philosophical area that's saying it was constructed by stellar fusion long before the solar, that is, in other words, billions of years ago, that's just a philosophical interpretation, okay? So yes, the top part here is science, right? But the bottom part here is just philosophical speculation. This is a one-time event that occurred when? In the unobserved past, okay? That's the key. That's the key. One-time event that occurred in the unobserved past. Well, science is a search for truth, the effort to understand the world. And I agree with this, even though this guy is an atheist. Linus Pauling, a two-time Nobel Prize-winning scientist, I agree with him. But today, in the 21st century, more and more secular scientists are what? They're not agreeing with this. You know why? Because they say either the truth is unknowable or the truth does not exist. And so for those two reasons, they would really question this. And how frustrating can that be, to be in a field of science and doing investigation and research, all with the idea in the back of your mind, there is no truth, or the truth is subjective. Hey man, what's true for you may not be true for me. And so I love this quote here, because I believe that Jesus is the John 14:6. Jesus is the truth. Jesus saith unto him, I am the way and the truth and the life, and that no one comes to the Father except by me. And so, yes, we say the truth is out there, as the science fiction story says. His name is Jesus. He is the way and the truth and the life. And what we try to do is to think God's thoughts after him. And that makes research in my field of, for example, invertebrate biology, eminently satisfying. Very satisfying to conduct that kind of research. Well, as a creation biologist, this is one of my favorite verses. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are, and here are the two key words, clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. Boy, there's a lot of theology there, in that last part, a lot of theology, deep, deep theology, so that they are without excuse. So this is the Apostle Paul speaking, not yours truly. Paul is saying point blank in one verse that God's creation is not only seen, but he says it's clearly seen. The Sherwin translation is painfully obvious. It's a joke. And so it's a clearly seen creation, so that, Paul says, they're without excuse. And so let's look at that this morning very quickly. I like this. Mom says to Calvin, time for your bath, let's go. And Calvin puts up his little hand and says, sorry, I'm in denial about baths. And she says, fine, plonk, go ahead and deny it. And Calvin says, nobody respects my denial. And really, in society today here in America, there's a lot of denial about evidence for creation. But Paul said that God's creation is not only seen, but clearly seen. So it's too bad that so many people are saying, no, I don't believe in creation, as sometimes you might be led to share. Well, I have to say that evolution is not clearly seen. God's creation, yes, clearly seen. Evolution is not clearly seen. It is a faith. We have to understand that. You know, when you talk about a cosmic explosion billions of years ago that's unobserved, you know, unrepeated event in the distant past, evolution is a faith that unknown chemicals came together in an unknown way, in an unknown place, in an unknown time, using an unknown process to produce life. And really, that's what evolution is all about. You know, I'm not trying to be, you know, sarcastic or anything, but really, with each and every one of these, they really don't know. You know, Darwin talked about a warm little pond where life supposedly evolved. They've never found that warm little pond, and they've never observed how life can come from non-life. And so is this why evolution is taught as a fact in taxpayer-paid public schools? As we say in Texas, I'm agin it, okay? I'm agin it, using our tax dollars to teach the next generation that they came from a fish. I think maybe we should use those tax dollars to teach good science instead of a philosophy like this. And that really is a philosophy, to say that people came from lower life forms over millions and millions of years. I have a 2-hour presentation just on human evolution. And it's part one, obviously, in part two, but scripture is true in Genesis chapter 2, where God describes man being created from the dust of the earth and not from some evolutionary process. So this is kind of where evolution is standing right now. And one of my favorite phrases is, science without debate is propaganda. Now, we at ICR love to discuss science and exchange ideas and all that. And that's what puts an edge on science and keeps us sharp, by being able to debate. Well, how do you know that? Well, did you consider this concept? Well, wait a minute, what about this paper that says, that's good science. And so science without debate is propaganda. Well, somebody said this, look at this, a fair result can be obtained only by fully stating and balancing the facts and arguments on both sides of each question. What are the both sides of each question? Creation and evolution, right? Those are the both sides of each question. Here's the question of the morning. Who said that? I mean, that's a great quote. I give them an A+, or whoever said it, for saying that, because you have to balance both sides of the question. Any guess? It's just us here this morning. Who do you suppose said that? The answer is Charles Darwin. And really, he said that right in his infamous book On the Origin of Species, published in 1859. And so I was on CNN long ago debating an evolutionist, and it was get his name there, but anyway, I was in a tiny studio in San Diego, and they put on one of his microphones, and all of a sudden I was on national Lou Dobbs is his name, program, and I was debating this lady, and you know, we kind of had fun. It was very brief, but this is how I started off my presentation, saying, you know, I really agree. And of course, they didn't know who said that, but Charles Darwin said that. Well, I like what Discover Magazine said about over a decade ago, but it's just as apropos today as it was when it was published a decade ago. We have a lot of really, really strange coincidences. And all of these coincidences are such that makes life possible. Well, that's not very scientific, is it? Strange coincidences? You write a scientific paper and put in there strange coincidences. It's not going to fly. You know, the referees of your paper would kind of circle that with a red pen. But that's what this individual said. Really, really strange coincidences. All of these coincidences are such that make life possible. And this comes from Tom Garrison. I mentioned Tom Garrison last night because he is no friend of the creationist, but he said, "What is extraordinary is a happy combination of circumstances. Our planet's orbit is roughly circular around a relatively stable star." By the way, 50% of American public does not know that our sun is a star. So statistically, that means the person sitting next to you. And so, yeah, our sun is a star, isn't it? But it's a particularly stable star. Isn't that great how that works out? Earth is large enough to hold an atmosphere, but not so large that its gravity would overwhelm. Its neighborhood is tranquil. Supernovae have not seared the surface with radiation. Oh, I hate it when that happens. But so what we find is our sun is giving life to Earth in just the right amounts, where you know, we're not being blasted by cosmic rays. And so it seems that evolutionists will consider coincidences and combinations of circumstances, but they won't contemplate the Creator. And that's kind of sad, isn't it? And yeah, we're all open to our interpretations, I understand that, but to teach coincidences and combinations of circumstances as fact, that's not good science. You know, we should be open to other interpretations. And so they won't contemplate the Creator. So we must build our worldview on the Bible, written by one who was there when? In the beginning. In the beginning. God was there. He saw what happened. And he left us the book of beginnings, which is the book of Genesis. I love what the psalmist says in Psalm 111. "The works of the Lord are great, sought out of all them that have pleasure therein." And so the works of the Lord really are great. God's creation really is clearly seen, as the Apostle Paul says. And so, you know, design means a designer, right? Creation means a creator. And if things look tailor-made, there might be a tailor. And so Genesis is the true origins account. Some people think Genesis is just a story, but all 50 chapters are written in the historical narrative Hebrew. All 50 chapters. And so God wants us to understand his creation. And so he wrote in terms that we can understand. And, you know, it's the book of Genesis stands. It really does. So creation science is based on Genesis chapter 1. We talked about that last night. How many times do we see the phrase "after their kind" in Genesis 1? 10 times. 10 times God said that he created after their kind. And so think about dogs, and I mentioned dogs last night. We have all sorts of varieties of dogs, just incredible variations. Either we have cold dogs or hot dogs. Dogs have always been dogs, okay? And by the way, it was delicious. But so dogs have always been dogs. There's no idea as to how the domestic dog came from a non-dog ancestor. And so what is the most common dog in Canada, the United States, and England? I just gave it away. Labrador Retriever, right. The most favorite dog in those three countries, Canada, United States, and the British Isles. And so we have how many kinds of Labradors? We got the what? You have the gold lab, we got the, there's a black lab. Yes, the black lab. And then what else do we have? We got the chocolate lab, right? So how many kind of labs do we have? Gold lab, black lab, chocolate lab. We have some strange neighbors in our cul-de-sac, and we're pretty sure they have a meth lab. But anyway, labs have always been what? Labs, very good, yeah. You know, dogs have always been dogs. And so the question is, where did domestic dogs come from? And the answer is, the history of today's dogs is still contentious. Now, you would think it would be easy to answer from an evolutionary context where dogs came from. After all, we're up to here, and that's a scientific measurement. Right here, we're up to here in dogs, aren't we? You know, this country is lousy with dogs. And so it, secular scientists, they have an opportunity to investigate and research that. 90 million dogs as pets, 90 million. And so, you know, we can investigate that, but really the origin of the dogs is pretty much unknown. What about cats? Well, little is known about the genetic changes that distinguish domestic cat populations from their wild progenitors. And there are 600 million domestic cats worldwide, last time I counted. And so we have lots and lots of cats out there, but cats have always been cats, dogs have always been dogs, right? So that's really the conclusion that people are coming to, and that's not very tidy from an evolutionary context. They should be able to answer where these creatures came from. The origin of domestic dogs is poorly understood, according to one researcher, and yet we're told to believe that fish fins turned into the legs and feet of the first amphibians. Have you been to a museum last couple of years where they show a diorama of a fish-like creature with half fins, half legs, and they're walking out on shore, you know, to get that baseball that they... And so really that is a diorama. It's an evolutionary artistic interpretation of what they think happened when the fish millions of years ago started getting beneficial mutations that turned the fins slowly and gradually into what? Legs, yeah. But fish have always been fish. Remember, dogs have always been dogs, cats have always been cats. I can assure you, fish have always been fish, all the way down to the Cambrian level. That's Cambrian sedimentary rocks there at the bottom of the geologic column. In 1996 in China, paleontologists found 100% fish in the lowest level of the geologic column. And guess what? Frogs have always been frogs. Now, the theory of evolution says that these fins somehow became these, the feet and legs of frogs. But there's been, I have an hour presentation on that in regard to the development. I get into embryology and also paleontology. But these two are very distinct, very distinct. There's a lot we don't know about the closest really living relatives of all tetrapods. I don't want to get into too much detail. A tetrapod, tetra means four, pod means foot, of four-footed creatures. And the gap between the tetrapod limb and the fin remains. And this individual said that very recently in 2016 in this book. This is not a Christian book. This guy, Michael Denton, is a medical doctor and also a PhD zoologist. And so he doesn't agree with the biblical account of creation, but he is what we call, say, intellectually honest about looking at the fossil record. He's intellectually honest about making the deduction about, did fish really turn into frogs? And this is a conclusion that he came to in that book. The gap, emphasize that, the gap between tetrapod limb and the fin remains. What do we say in creation science? Fish have always been fish, and frogs, the amphibians, have always been frogs. So Barras said in New Scientist 2 years ago, the evolutionary story we have written to explain our ancestors' move from the sea to the land, may need a rethink. That was said just 2 years ago, may need a rethink. And I salute them, you know, I'm not criticizing them, I salute them for admitting that, hey, they're gonna have to rethink their position there. That's great, that's how science operates. But could I also make a prediction this morning? I'll predict that they won't come to any conclusion about how fish grew legs and went onto the land, because it never happened. Remember, God created after their kind. And so, again, I applaud them for saying that, and that shows the dynamic nature of science. Well, what about human evolution? Over the past 15 years, almost every part of our story, every assumption about who our ancestors were and where we came from has been called into question. When was that said? 2 years ago. 2 years ago. Now, here's something I'd like to suggest this morning, and it's just a suggestion. You know, let's take this quote here and let's put it in the section on human evolution in American taxpayer-paid biology textbooks, okay? So you've got these biology textbooks for high school students. They're paid for by our tax dollars. All we are asking, we're requesting, and by the way, it's never going to happen, is to take this quote. Are there any Bible verses in this quote? No, any mention of Scripture, of God? Let's take this quote and put it in that wide white margin in that section on human evolution so that the student, what? Will get both sides of the story, right? That's all. It's not that, you know, oh, they must believe that in the beginning God. No, that's, you know, that's up to the parents, you know, teaching them and all, and you know, if the Lord leads to share with them. But this would be a breath of fresh air, wouldn't it? Where the student would be reading all about human evolution and then come across this interesting quote. Over the past 15 years, almost every part of our story, every assumption about who our ancestors were, and you see the rest of the quote there, that's very, very revealing from a publication that is not a Christian publication by any stretch. But anyway, I wanted to share with Pastor Ben that this does remind me of a Bible verse. And so I've tweaked the Bible verse. Okay, I've adjusted a little bit. I trust you'll forgive me on that. But when it comes to the fossil record shouts creation, doesn't it? What do we say in creation science? The missing links are missing. The missing links are missing. And fossils speak of death, not development. Fossils speak of extinction, not evolution. And something I didn't mention last night, and you can write this down, floods form, fossils fast. Floods form, fossils fast. And the reason why we have such a great fossil record is that it looks like flooding, massive flooding, formed those fossils not too long ago. Wait, Frank, what do you mean not too long ago? Well, remember what we've been finding? Soft dinosaur tissue, not that long ago. So anyway, I took a verse and I kind of adjusted a little bit, Pastor Ben. Now, evolution is the substance of fossils hoped for, the evidence of links not seen. Okay. And so maybe that's a way that we could, you know, use that verse. And it's just between us here this morning. But that's really kind of where it stands. Well, let's look at the cosmos just very quickly. There's only three options for the origin of this universe. Number one is it's always existed. Number two, it suddenly appeared from nothing. Or number three, door number three, it was created supernaturally. So these are the only choices that we have when we talk about the origin of this entire universe. And I do want to share a quote from Scientific American as we look at these three doors, these three choices. Here, Guthin Steinhardt said in Scientific American in the mid-80s, it is then tempting to go one step further and speculate. There's a scientific word there. Speculate that the entire universe evolved from what? Literally nothing. And so here we have this individual saying, or individuals, two of them saying that everything, you know, let's speculate, everything came from nothing. They are free to do that. And I'm not condemning them. I'm not criticizing them. I'm just comparing and contrasting the secular worldview versus the biblical worldview. And so this is what they're saying here. There's no scientific evidence. You know, you can't go into a laboratory, adjust the bills and the bells and the whistles, and show that something can come from nothing. And so that's kind of what they're saying. Our unique solar system is very, very unique. We have all these planets lined up, and we've learned about the solar system in junior high, right? And the solar system is absolutely amazing. So what's the closest star to Earth? Does anybody know what our closest star is to Earth?
Besides the sun?
No, the sun is right. Yeah, that's it, the sun. A for the morning. The sun is our closest star to Earth. And if we can't understand our sun, how can secular scientists claim to know so much about the origin of the universe? Let's just talk about the closest star to us, which is the sun. Our yellow dwarf star, that is our sun, is in many ways a mystery. The overreaching corona, you know what the corona is, the flames coming out from the surface of the sun, is hundreds of times hotter than the sun's actual surface. Boy, I didn't know that, and they just found that out. The surface of the sun is cool, relatively speaking, compared to the great waves of flames that are coming out from the surface of the sun. And this is confounding scientists. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's good to be confounded because that causes you to ask more questions, right? So certainly we're not criticizing that in any stretch. In addition, physicists don't know what's driving the solar wind. And the solar wind comes out from the sun and could possibly devastate the Earth except for one thing. God created in our planet a rotating iron core. Do you remember Physics 101? A rotating metal creates a what? A magnetic field or an electric field, electromagnetic field, however you want to say it. And so God, in his infinite wisdom, has placed a rotating iron core in the Earth, setting up an electrical field that you can see here that then causes the solar wind to not destroy us. As you can see, it's deflected there. And I hate it when solar winds come in and, you know, make all sorts of problems. It just ruins your day. But isn't that neat how that works out? And so that's just one evidence of creation. It kind of reminds me of a verse in the Bible when I look at this. It's found in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, where Paul says God's creation is, and he uses two words, clearly seen. So God's creation is clearly seen as the deflection of the solar wind due to a rotating iron core. So how was a solar system built? You know, where did the solar system come from? Well, this one individual said, this is one of my favorite quotes when it comes to our solar system. You might also think that these disparate bodies are scattered across the solar system without rhyme or reason. He's talking about the planets and the moons of the planets. And he says, just kind of looks like they were just spread out, kind of just willy-nilly. But move any piece of the solar system today, or try to add anything more, and the whole construction would be thrown fatally out of kilter. What's he saying here? And this is a secular individual. He's saying that our planets, you know, Venus, Neptune, Mars, and Mercury, and Saturn, and, well, even little Pluto. Pluto looks like it's getting voted back into the fraternity of planets. You know, in what, 12, 15 years ago was voted out. And people in that time were saying, well, I wasn't fired, I was Plutoed. Kind of a joke. But anyway, and all of these planets are arranged in such a way that if you take one away or take the moons away, you'd be thrown fatally out of kilter. It's almost like they were designed that way. It reminds me of a verse in the Bible. It's found in the book of Romans, chapter 1, in verse 20, where the Apostle Paul says, God's creation is clearly seen, clearly seen. And then he asks this rhetorical question at the end of the statement. He says, so how exactly did this delicate architecture come to be? I love that quote. It's wonderful that he is asking, you know, it's good that he's asking questions. Whether you're a creationist or an evolutionist, it's good to ask science questions, right? And so he asks this question here at the end, but he says, delicate architecture, how do you get delicate architecture except by an all-wise, all-knowing architect with capital A? And so that really is kind of neat. And so we would have the answer, wouldn't we? God's creation is clearly seen. In a stunning surprise, almost all the newly discovered solar systems look very different from our own. And this was said way back in 2018. And so as they continue to study the solar systems out there that we can see, they're seeing that ours is a very unique solar system, isn't it? That all the other solar systems they've been seeing are very different. Once again, we're seeing an indirect case for creation. We would freely predict that they're never going to find a solar system just like ours. Oh, Frank, the universe is really big. That's true. That's true. But ours is a uniquely constructed solar system. Move any one of those planets and moons in our solar system and it's lights out. One evolutionist said way back in the year 2019, according to a new simulation, our home system is even, here's a scientific word, weirder than we thought. Okay, that was said this year. This year they look at our solar system and say, wow, our system is even weirder than we thought. Weirder is a scientific word meaning unique. Very, very unique. Well, over-tilting exoplanets, I don't want to get into this. It was said just this year, season of a planet with a large axial tilt are much more extreme than those of a well-aligned planet. In other words, this suggests our Earth and Moon and Sun are not product of random cosmic accidents. And again, this was said just this year. We're seeing more and more and more through research, this solar system that we live in is incredibly unique. I won't get into that. Okay, a French astrophysicist said, and I quote, he discovered that the orbits of Jupiter and Saturn keep the Earth's orbit from becoming chaotic. They didn't find this out until just a couple of years ago. They realized that these very large planets, Saturn and Jupiter, are arrayed in such a way in the planetary alignment in their orbital velocity that without their orbital stability produced, the Earth's orbit would make extreme changes, causing instability in our own climate, and making the Earth uninhabitable. It is inhabitable due in part to Saturn and Jupiter and their gravitational interaction with the Earth. And so, have you thanked the Lord for Jupiter and Saturn in your devotions? But really, that's what it is. It's just amazing how this all works out. And by the way, some of the super planets in our solar system, like Jupiter and Saturn, act as a kind of a running back, a linebacker for us, in that they have a very large gravitational attraction. So that when those pesky comets and asteroids come into our solar system, they are pulled away by the gravitational attraction of these super planets, and so they don't bombard us as they usually would. And so God is looking out for us, isn't he? And pulling away those comets and asteroids. Isn't that neat? Well, there's a book called Astronomy Today, the 8th edition, and the two secular authors, Chiasson and McMillan, said, Earth is neither central nor special. We inhabit no unique place in the universe. And that's quite a statement to make. I mean, you know, they make three statements that can't be verified. And so again, you remember what I said earlier, that we have to make a distinction between where science leaves off and philosophy begins? Here's a perfect example right here. Has anybody studied the entire universe? No, we've studied less than 1%, even with these great telescopic arrays that we have on Earth and the Hubble Space Telescope and other space telescopes out there. We're just seeing a fraction of God's created universe, so much so that we cannot possibly say this. Now, they can say that if they want to, and I'm not criticizing them. All I'm doing this morning is helping you to see where science leaves off and philosophy begins. That's all I'm doing. And so they should kind of be careful when they make statements like that that can't possibly be verified. Well, these two individuals, Ward and Brownlee, are no creationists. They are evolutionists, but they wrote a book long ago, several decades ago now, called Rare Earth, Why Complex Life is Uncommon in the Universe. And so, going back to the previous quote, we inhabit no unique place in the universe. Well, these individuals, Ward and Brownlee, who are also atheists, beg to differ. They beg to differ. We are, in fact, living in a very, very unique place in the universe. And folks, they have no theological axe to grind, okay? They are simply looking at the uniqueness of planet Earth and making it public. Two other secular authors, as I say, beg to differ. We live in a very special place in the solar system. And here are some examples. Earth has just the right rotation. I didn't realize this. Life cannot exist on a planet that rotates too fast or too slow. This is yet another Goldilocks problem for astrobiologists to consider, and that was said in 2014. Well, not only is the rotation of our planet just exactly what it should be, but also the size of our planet is exactly right. If our planet was a lot bigger or smaller, life would not exist. It just so happens that the diameter of this planet is where it's exactly supposed to be. But not only the diameter, but the tilt of the planet, the distance of this planet from the sun, all sorts of parameters have to be not close, they've got to be exact in order for life to exist. And here it is. The habitability zone of Earth is just right. It's not too cold, it's not too hot, just exactly where it's supposed to be at the right tilt and the right diameter. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's all sorts of other factors that come into play as well. So what about our moon? Well, two researchers looked at the moon and came to the conclusion the moon is incredibly sophisticated and complex. We think it's just a body that orbits the Earth, but our moon is just exactly right. It is not close to being right, it is exactly right. It's 1/400th the diameter of the sun, and it's at a distance from the sun, so that the moon, when it comes between us and the sun, is such that it forms what we call a perfect eclipse, so that we can study the corona of the sun, which you cannot do at any other time. But the moon is just exactly right, so much so that they wrote this book called Who Built the Moon? Now remember, they're atheists. They denigrate a creationist in this book, and this is written in the early 2000s. But because of all the evidence that they looked at, this is the conclusion they came to. Well, this reminds me of a verse in the Bible. It's found in the book of Romans, chapter 1, and verse 20. So in other words, what we're seeing here is when these individuals who are not creationists look at the evidence, they are driven to the conclusion that the moon must have been created. Somebody must have made the moon. But they don't consider the Bible because, again, they don't believe that. And so, I hesitate to say this, they believe in time travel. So after they look at all the parameters of the moon, which are correct, they're all you can verify and validate it. Since they're not creationists, they have to say, well, man became so highly evolved, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years from this time, that they were able to see the importance of the moon. So they invented time travel to go back and build the moon. Strange stuff, and I usually don't say that to an audience, but anyway, who built the moon? And this is said in 2017, just 2 years ago, the moon's origin remains puzzling. So you would think by this time, this is the closest celestial body to Earth. Surely they would know answers to the closest celestial. This is the only place where we've walked on the moon, right? And even then, just two short years ago, they're saying the moon's origin, the origin, is still enigmatic. It's still puzzling. And we're not criticizing the evolutionists, bless our heart. They're trying to come to a knowledge of the truth, but without God, they never will. That's our point. And so I appreciate, again, their intellectual honesty. They're to be applauded. Oh, yeah. Did you know that they found insects on the moon? A lot of people don't realize that. Scientists are calling them lunatics. Thank you. So, living things clearly look like they were designed, so how do evolutionists know that they were not designed? I like to use the brain as an example. Those 3 pounds that are found between your ears is the most sophisticated accumulation of matter in the known universe. Okay, will we ever understand the brain? We never will. We will never understand. Frank, you should never say never. We will never understand the brain. The brain is simply too complex. It is so sophisticated. And how it came about by time and chance is not really been explained very well. So living things clearly look like they were designed. And maybe we should go what? We should go down the design trail, right? If it looks designed, let's go ahead and entertain that idea. Well, I already talked about the bombardier beetle last night, didn't I? And so I don't want to be redundant and repeat myself. But here it is, 28 hydrogen peroxide, the hydroquinone. Here's a beetle getting mad because this guy put his fingernail on his leg and he's blasting away. This is evidence of design. And the reason why I show this is to show that all of these features have to be showing up at once in order to have a functional bombardier beetle. It would be no good just to have this thing walking around for hundreds of thousands of years with just a hydrogen peroxide or just a hydroquinone. That's a waste of energy, right? Because it couldn't help the creature. So you've got to have this and this working together, but then you need enzymes in the explosion sac, and enzymes work very, very specifically. And so all that has to be working together. The beetle needs inhibitors, enzymes, glands, combustion tubes, sensory communication, and muscles to direct the combustion tubes. and a finely tuned nervous system all inside this 2.5-inch beetle. And by the way, can I say this without hesitation? Beetles have always been beetles. See how easy science is? Beetles have always been beetles. I did a study, and in the fossil record, they have fossilized beetles. Okay, no idea where beetles came from. Beetles have always been beetles. So did all of the units here come about by time and mutations and chance, or by plan and purpose? This is evolution. This is creation, plan and purpose, the mind of the creator. So that's a question we should ask. Do we normally attribute these high precision gears from an explosion in a steel mill? Now, obviously, I'm talking to my engineering son. Of course, these gears can't turn, can they? They'd lock up immediately. I'm just trying to show you what the gears look like and ask the question, how do you attribute the gears, their origin? Explosions in steel mill is kind of a bad way of explaining how they came about. Well, using an electron microscope magnifies things thousands and thousands of times, a lot more than the high school or college light microscope that you used in your introductory biology classes. Electron microscopes are very expensive and very heavy, and they have to have their own foundation because any vibration will cause problems. And a British zoologist took pictures of the legs of this tiny insect using an electron microscope. He used an electron microscope, got right in and looked at the legs of this planthopper nymph. And he took the pictures of these legs because he was noticing how the planthopper nymph was able to jump so directly, so efficiently. And he said, and he's an atheist at the University of Bristol, he said this a couple of years ago, what we have is a prototype for incredibly small, high-speed, high-precision gears. What was he talking about? Well, he had just used that electron microscope. This is the picture he took. Do you see those gears?
Mm-hmm.
These are living gears. And you know what? The hair in the back of your neck goes up when you see something like this, because you look at that and you say, that reminds me of a verse in the Bible. And it really does. It really does. And so much so that Sutton, the author, used a paragraph in his paper of the pictures he took to say this wasn't designed. They weren't created. He actually says that in the paper. Why? Because this looks so clearly designed. And so he has to backpedal and say, okay, this is what I discovered, but it's not creation. It wasn't created. And he's free to do that. I'm not criticizing him. I think it's interesting he'd use a paragraph to do that. So living things clearly look like they were designed. So how do evolutionists know that they were not designed when you see such clear evidence for design? This is the Escherichia coli bacterium. This is the one bacterium that is used most in research laboratories throughout the world, E. coli. 1% of your microbiome in your large intestine is made up of E. coli bacterium. What are these thread-like projections coming off here? Anybody know? They're called, begins the letter F, flagellum. These are flagellum. And when they twist in such a way that it helps the E. coli to get around. And so what I want to do very quickly as we're drawing to a close here is show how this flagellum goes into the E. coli bacterium. It has to go into the cell wall in such a way as that it will be anchored there, but also being able to turn. So here is how it goes into the cell wall. We just saw it in the previous slide. It goes into the cell wall here, and look at that design feature there. Well, researchers were very, very interesting. So they took a population of E. coli in a sample, and they used literally a blender, busted up. And then they painstakingly plated out the fractured portions of the E. coli, and they found the motor. It's like literally finding a needle in a haystack. This is just a diagram. This is an actual electron micrograph, a grainy white and black picture of this E. coli bacterial motor, electron micrograph of the motor itself. And look at the words that they're using to describe this: hook, motor, Well, motors come about by time and chance and explosions and, no. And all of these other features here, again, the hair in the back of the neck goes up because you are seeing the very fingerprint of the Creator here. And this is magnified hundreds of thousands of times. This is, whew. So we would look, you know, Roy would say this is designed, he's a mechanical engineer, and you can look at this, a unit here, and say, yeah, that's designed. But the secular community will look at the flagellar motor, the electron micrograph picture I just showed you, and say, no, it's not designed. You know, this is huge, this is infinitely tiny, tiny. But yet, what are the kind of words that they use to describe it? Well, drive shaft, bushing, universal joint, rotor, rings, clutch. Clutch? Is there a clutch in this thing? Yeah, a couple of years ago they did research and found out this flagellar motor has a clutch. And we would ask the question, which is more complex and sophisticated? Well, the more you study this, it's a no-brainer. This is more complex, this is more sophisticated than this clunky old thing right here will ever be. And the difference is in their size. Their size is extremely small in this. But I really like that clutch idea. So we did some studying, and here it is. They found that this thing actually has a sub-microscopic clutch, of course, made of 100% protein. And so you can see when the clutch is engaged versus when the clutch is disengaged here in this flagellar motor. And I can't think that this would come about by time and chance and good mutations, if there is such a thing. But again, we can see the very fingerprint of the Creator, can we not? And we can glorify Him, give Him glory. Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. Oh, and by the way, this is the motor system inside the bacterial cell, the E. coli cell. This all has to go on as the E. coli uses its motor, and it can go forwards and spin backwards within a fraction of a second. And all of this has to be working in harmony, in conjunction, to have this motor system operating. We're talking about the inside of a single bacterial cell that you can barely see with a light microscope, that really you need an electron microscope to see. All of that is going on inside just this one bacterium. Oh, wait a minute. This is the sensory system. I forgot to mention that. The sensory system also has to be working at the same time as the motor system in order for the E. coli to sense its environment and go to places where the pH is more neutral, not low, which is acidic, and it just ruined its day. And so you would have to have a sensory system inside this tiny E. coli bacterium. And, well, let's superimpose the two, the motor system and the sensory system. All of this is going on inside the tiny bacterial cell. But also, I didn't mention, wow, I forgot about that. It needs energy, doesn't it? And so with energy, you need to have glycolysis. It's breaking down a 6-carbon sugar molecule into 2 energy-rich pyruvic acid molecules, which then goes through the pyruvate dehydrogenase system, releasing a carbon and going through the pyruvate dehydrogenase to pick it up and go into the Krebs cycle. Krebs cycle takes a 4-carbon molecule, adds it to the 2-carbon acetyl group, and becoming a very brief but a sophisticated 6-carbon molecule, which then loses one of the carbons, becomes a 5-carbon molecule, a 4-carbon molecule, another 2-carbon acetyl group comes in, hooks up to it, and that's the way the Krebs cycle works. But to what purpose? Well, the Creator has designed that Krebs cycle to use enzymes to carve off hydrogens. What are hydrogens? They're energy-rich entities. The reason why you eat meals right now is to get hydrogen. That's the only reason. Orange juice, you know, a candy bar, it's all to get hydrogen. And so the Creator's designed enzymes that carve off those hydrogen atoms from the 6-carbon, the 5-carbon, the 4-carbon units, and then you get another 2-carbon acetyl group. And the special enzyme that carves off those hydrogens is called nicotinamine adenine dinucleotide phosphate. And it takes the NADH and takes it to the special feature that takes the phosphorylation of that and produces energy called adenosine diphosphate, which comes from adenosine triphosphate. So ADP, adenosine diphosphate, has to be phosphorylated by the nicotine adenine dinucleotide phosphate into the ATP, which is the energy currency of the cell. And so here we have it. It's a lot easier to understand here. Here's the tricarboxylic acid cycle or the Krebs cycle. Here are the various features that are going on here. This all is going on inside of the E. coli bacterium. And this is what one evolutionist, well, several evolutionists said just last year. The emergence of the pathways that now comprise core and central metabolism, or even intermediate metabolism, is particularly enigmatic. When was that said? Last year. So what I just described to you in this tongue twister description there of how the bacterium achieves its energy is as far as last year, is unknown. It's particularly puzzling. Nothing wrong with that. Again, I salute the secular community for admitting in print that it's still puzzling. That's great. That's how we do science. Ask the questions. But this is this is what's happening here. And it's happening in all of the trillion cells of your body right now. Right now, in these very, very small metabolic machines called enzymes that are made of 100% protein. And then a multitude of other metabolic events that make biochemical pathways look like printed circuits of high-tech electronic equipment. So look at the analogy they're using in that pathway that I just described to you. Here's the analogy. These secular authors in the parasitology book that I've come pretty close to memorizing as a graduate student equated the biochemical pathways with high-tech electronic equipment. Isn't that neat? Well, that reminds me of a verse in the Bible. It's found in the book of Romans. And as the secular professor says to the Christian, how can you seriously believe that all of this is a result of intelligence? That's kind of sad the way that it's being said today in a lot of colleges and universities. Well, there are so much other things that I could share. Cosmic rays come in and mess up the DNA. Here's the DNA molecule. And right now we're getting hit by cosmic rays, but not nearly as many as if we didn't have that rotating iron core. And we get mutations. Here's a mutation on the DNA molecule. Changes in various things that occur when the cosmic ray hits, specifically the DNA in the nucleus of our cell. Okay, here's some other things. I guess in a part two of my lecture, but the point is, what we're learning points clearly to creation. The normal fruit fly is what's used. Remember E. coli, I said, was used in research laboratories? Well, the animal is here, the normal fruit fly, Drosophila, that's used ubiquitously throughout research labs throughout the world. And fruit flies have always been fruit flies. Beetles have always been beetles. And so you can mutate these poor little fruit flies here and produce all sorts of monstrosities, but they're still what? They're still fruit flies. Okay, I've gone over time a little bit here. So will we take a break and then do question or however you want to do it, Pastor?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's up to you guys. You guys just need to probably a quick, very brief break if you want to go to the restroom. Just a couple minutes, and then we'll do question and answer. And I think maybe a good way to start that would be just to talk about your own testimony and how the Lord has blessed you. So
great. Right. Okay, a couple of minutes.
Yep. Just a couple of minutes, and then we'll come back.
Okay.